at least 6 or 7 different Native Americans that stood up and dominated the conversation in a room full of non-natives. And I was like, oh, it's happening. We're switching the paradigm.
Welcome back to the Klamath Tribe News Podcast, a place to hear the news of the nation. This is your host, Courtney Neubauer, Interim Director of Public Relations, and today I am joined by Gabrielle Abbey Hall, a professor of ethnic studies at Central Oregon Community College. Abby was born and raised in Fort Klamath and attended school in Chiloquin. She is also an enrolled member of the Klamath Tribes and someone recently involved with a very important documentary, Coming to Klamath, Uncovering Boarding Schools, Stories of Resistance and Resilience. The film is being shown October 24th at the Ross Raglan Theater in Klamath Falls and will be shown in Forest Grove October 28th at Pacific University. Both events are free and open to the public, but you are encouraged to get tickets in advance at opb.org/events. The film follows Abby's journey as she uncovers the hidden stories of her family's experiences in Native American boarding schools, stretching from the first generation forced into a reservation to the present era. Welcome, Abby. I want to invite you. Is there any other way you would like to introduce yourself or anything you wanted to add before we get started?
No, Waklisi, thank you.
Amadeski, how has your day been so far? What are you bringing or carrying with you here today?
It's been a good day. Woke up to frost this morning in Central Oregon, so that was a pleasant surprise. The seasons are shifting, but all is well. Thank you.
Yes, and you're just diving into classes as well. Professor is definitely in the title.
Yeah, we started September 22nd, and so we're just kind of getting into the swing of things.
And so we're here today to talk about this film. And I know that many of our listeners will probably be familiar with what boarding schools are and were. But for folks who may be a little bit less familiar, could you give a description?
The forced removal of children predates and assimilation predates, you know, the federal boarding school policy. And it became federal policy, federally funded in 1887. And that's when the federal government started opening federally run boarding schools. And, you know, that began with Carlisle and then followed by Forest Grove, which is now Chemawa. But prior to that, all the way back to the 1600s, the U.S. government and government officials were encouraging basically settlers to take Native American children in and to, you know, teach them English, to teach them religion. And so if you put a date on it, it would be 1887 and forward. But the reality is that, you know, governors and people were encouraging people to do this all the way back. I think one of the earliest dates I saw was 1606. Benjamin Franklin was also, you know, a big proponent of take these children from their families and raise them up and educate them. And so it's been going on a lot longer through several different capacities than just the federal boarding school era that became well known in, you know, 1880 to 1887 through legislation.
That's really, really powerful. There's a couple names and dates that surprised me. And so I'm also super excited to watch the film and learn those lessons, which are heavy ones. And I have a curiosity around how you sort of started that conversation about boarding schools within your own family and who have been some of the pillars for you as you've moved through these investigations?
I feel that my family is probably not unique. You know, I've heard other people talk about this, but growing up, you did not talk about boarding schools. You know, I knew my grandma had gone to Haskell, Indian school, and that she was separated from her sisters and they went to a different boarding school. But I just remember, Trina and Taylor going to Haskell, Tupper. And when they went, it was an exciting thing. They were going to college. So in my head, I always thought that Haskell was like this great place that, you know, you went to college and you were doing well if you went there. I didn't know that it had been a boarding school prior to that. And because my grandma just never talked about it, and she did talk about it more with some of my other cousins, but I kind of had this removed sense that, okay, that happened a long time ago and we don't really talk about it. And then I had this different perception of what Haskell is today than what Haskell was founded to do. And Haskell's an Indian boarding school in Lawrence, Kansas, which is now an Indian college. And so the reputation is very different, but it has a very long history. But once I kind of shifted my perception of what these boarding schools were and started to learn about them, I was actually doing an interview with a guy from OPB. And I said, you know, before my grandma got shipped off to Haskell, she went to Canyonville Bible Academy. That was probably a boarding school. And I didn't know that. And so I got off the phone with this guy and I did a Google search and I found out that Canyonville Bible Academy in Canyonville, Oregon, was a boarding school. And my grandma was sent there. And I didn't know that until I knew she had gone there, but I didn't know it was a boarding school until probably 3 years ago. And then during this research process, the OPB producer, Cammy Horton, actually called down to Canyonville Bible Academy and got my grandma's original enrollment documents. And you see that in the film. And she got some other documents. And side note, Canyonville was really happy to help her in her first couple of phone calls. And, you know, after she kept asking for information, they just straight up said, no, we will send you no more information. Don't contact us again. And it wasn't anything Cammy did that was offensive. It was that she was bringing up this history. So that's kind of how I uncovered it in my own family. I had known that my family had gone to boarding schools, but again, it just wasn't talked about. And so there's some different elders in the film. One is Clay Dumont Sr. And I've talked to him, you know, way more than I ever talked to my own grandma about boarding schools, just because I think the elders now are coming forward with their stories and are sharing those. And it's platforms like this that say, hey, we want to hear what happened. We want to know. And I hope that those elders that are coming forward are in a more supportive place to share their experiences than they were kind of in the thick of it going through it. And so, yeah, that's kind of how I got into it. And I think a lot of families are probably there where they know a relative went to boarding school, but they never had direct conversations, maybe just kind of words in passing. And so if there, anything comes out of this project to, you know, have those conversations now and to ask those questions of our elders, I think is really important. But that's kind of my family journey through it. Was I didn't even know that she had gone to Canyonville Bible Academy as a boarding school until probably 3 years ago.
That's so powerful. That name is new to me. I didn't know that was one of the boarding schools, which is, I'm sure, going to be a not unfamiliar experience for people watching the film to say, oh wow, that was a boarding school too, and thinking of all of those places where people maybe didn't traditionally think was.
Yeah, and I'm going to hit on that a little bit later, but that's one of my biggest issues. And one of the things I really wanted to push through the film is there's an umbrella organization called the Boarding School Healing Coalition. And Deb Holland did an in-depth report, a two-part report over the course of 4 years, and they came out and they updated that boarding school list. And the boarding school list went from, I don't have the exact numbers here, but it went from about 300 to 500 schools. And so I'm like, oh, awesome research. And then I went to Oregon and I looked at Oregon, and the Boarding School Healing Coalition and Deb Holland's report do not mentioned the religious schools that we know for a fact that our tribal members went to. And just in my research alone, there are 6 schools that we had tribal members attend. Every day you probably walk by the education office, and outside the education office and tribal admin is a picture of our tribal member sitting on the steps of St. Mary's. And per the Boarding School Healing Coalition and the federal government, that is not a federal Indian boarding school. And so that was one of my like main goals was like, no, these schools need to be held accountable just as much as, you know, the Chihuahuas, the Haskells, the Carlisles. And so I'm going to name those schools just so that we can talk about it. But they're St. Mary's, which is that's where the picture is outside of admin. Sacred Heart in Klamath Falls, Kenyonville Vital Academy, Mount Vernon, Mount Angel, and St. Andrews. So that's just the six that we've found. And we interviewed like 25 people. Who knows how many are out there? And then, you know, to this day, they refuse to come forward with records and documents. And it's time.
I appreciate that so much. That finding that missing piece in the record and getting to ask the questions, why is it missing too? And wow, six in 25 interviews is really telling that there's more work to be done.
For sure.
And as this, you know, film has started to launch in a few places locally, what has been your experiences at those launches and what can people expect when they head over to some of the viewings we mentioned at the top?
Well, the first viewing was in Bend, and that was a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, it was at the Tower Theater, and the Tower Theater sold out. And so I was like, oh, my gosh, there's an audience for this. This is amazing. And then we went and had the viewing, and I hadn't seen the film. And so, of course, you know, it hits really hard because we had been recording over the course of about 2 years, maybe longer. And I had just been sending Cammie the producer thing. So there was a lot of things like, oh, my God, I forgot I sent her that picture. And I forgot I said that, you know, all these things that kind of were compiled together. And so watching the film was amazing. And in my mind, I thought that it was going to include, you know, this is the boarding school experience for Oregon. But it is very specific to the Klamath tribes. And so I kind of thought we were going to be sharing that stage with kind of the rest of Oregon, but she dialed in on the Klamath tribes and our experience. And so that was a fabulous surprise. And then at the end, we did a question and answer. And so I've been doing these sorts of talks for about 5 years now. And my native audience is always, you know, the minority, a small group. And there was, you know, a couple hundred people there. And maybe 5% of them are Native. And every person that got up and talked afterwards was Natives and got up, spoke to their experience. One lady who was Alaska Native and Dene, who was raised up in Alaska, said that she came, but she was scared to come and kind of confront this history on her own. And so she brought a friend with her. And so that was really powerful. Then another survivor of boarding school from Warm Springs was there. But I don't know if you've sat in these sorts of rooms. It's not Native people that get up and talk and ask questions. And so it really, for me, it was showed the shift of we don't talk about this to we now talk about it, we acknowledge it, and we show how we're healing. And so that was so powerful to see because when you sit in these rooms, it's usually dominated by, you know, a dominant society and asking questions and learning more, but it's not the Natives that get up and talk and ask questions. And there was probably at least six or seven different Native Americans that stood up and dominated the conversation in a room full of non-Natives. And I was like, ah, it's happening. We're switching the paradigm. And so that was a great takeaway. And then because the Tower Theater sold out so quickly, we went ahead and did a showing at COCC, Central Oregon Community College, for Indigenous Peoples Day. And so that will be happening on Monday. And, you know, OPB was great. They're just like, you know what? As long as it's free, you can show it. And so we'll be showing it there as well. And so all around, it was a great experience. I was surprised, though, as I was watching the documentary, I was like, oh, my goodness. And then I was like, oh, my goodness, because I hate being in front of the camera. but it was good. It was a great overall experience. And to see it welcomed so much, so welcomed here in Central Oregon, and then to see the Indigenous people just stand up and acknowledge it and their place, because it's reflecting our history, the Klamath tribe's history, but it resonated with every other person in that room, Indigenous and non-Indigenous. And so it was a great experience.
It gave me tingles too, just thinking like pack house sold out, and to create that space where people feel being safe, and because it can be a risk to come up to a mic and share. So that must have been so powerful. And so I'm really excited to see what happens when you come down here in Klamath. And also, yeah, just to know, like, you hadn't seen the full film, so everything got to be sort of unveiled to you in real time as well. Must have been, I'm imagining, like, slightly overwhelming, but equally exciting, hopefully.
Oh, it was. It was at the very beginning. And of course, I packed some Kleenexes, but they started showing these pictures of my grandma, and I had forgotten I had given them to her. And so I just started crying. And then I had an elder behind me. Smokey Miller was sitting in a row behind me. And so I got out my Kleenexes and I went and handed him some, because I was like, oh my gosh, this is the opening scene. There's no way I'm going to make it through this. But I knew if I was feeling that, seeing all those old pictures, that he would feel that and stuff. And so, yeah, I was like, buckle up, because it was the very like opening scenes that I was already losing it. But yeah, it was good.
Oh, I love that too, that connection. You're like, I know I'm not going to be the only one. And at the opening scene, getting to feel that so deeply and seeing your relatives on the screen. Wow. Wow. And so this next upcoming showing is at the school that you teach. Is that part of the many hats you wear and things that you juggle professionally and personally? And wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about your journey to be a member of the Klamath Tribes, and go from Chiloquin, which, where I'm sure, you know, maybe some of our young listeners are looking and thinking at your journey. And was wondering if you wanted to say anything about how that journey has been for you and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah. Well, born and raised in Fort Klamath, attended a school in Chiloquin, graduated there. And then I went to OSU. And it wasn't until I got to OSU that I realized that being Native American or being from Chiloquin was different, or kind of set you apart. Because in Chiloquin, everybody was Native. And so then when I got to that big campus, and, you know, there's 200 people in my math class, and there was 34 people in my graduating class, I had a bit of a culture shock. And so I was able to go to the Native American Longhouse there. And there was people, you know, from Warm Springs and Sulettes, and they were funny. They had Native sense of humor. They got me. They got small town. They got, you know, maybe growing up on a ranch. And so I made that huge campus a lot smaller by relying on being Native. And that's kind of where I started to dig into my culture. Because, you know, my dad had always Indian rodeoed. I'd done Indian basketball, Indian softball tournaments, all of those things. But I didn't realize maybe the uniqueness of it when I was in the middle of doing that. It wasn't until I left that I realized how special that truly was. And so that was kind of where I started my journey. You know, we started helping out with the OSU powwow and those things. And then after I graduated from there, I ended up in Central Oregon and did a career change where I went back to education after about 15 years and two kids. And so I, again, had to kind of redefine what I was doing. And so now, to kind of keep all my hats straight, I would say my family's number one, my kids, and chasing them around and trying to connect them from a distance with their Indigenous culture. And then I do these, you know, my passion projects. I volunteer with the Education Committee or the Senate Bill 13, First Foods. And so I feel really privileged to be able to remain connected that way. And, you know, I would say my best piece of advice is to enjoy being in that community when you're there, because you'll realize how much you miss it once you're gone. And then my second piece of advice, from, you know, juggling everything from, you know, dropping kids at practice to, you know, doing an interview this morning, is to be in the moment.
everybody talks about balance. And for me, balance is just impossible. But if I can be centered in one moment. And so right now I'm centered here with you. And when I'm with my kids, I'm centered in that moment. And so I think that's where I was able to find success. And it wasn't easy. You know, I was going back to graduate school for the second time with a one-year-old and trying to balance that. And it's like, no, I'm here with my child now. I may have, you know, 5 hours worth of homework to do, but that's, don't take away from this moment. Be centered here, and then you can be centered there at a different time. And so those are kind of my, I wouldn't say they're tips to success, but that's how I survive.
And for survival, also
success.
We'll talk about that. What do your kiddos think about the works that you're doing? And they must feel like they're related to kind of a famous superstar seeing you on the big screen.
They just wanted to see themselves on the big screen. They're so funny. I am much more introverted and their father is much more extroverted. And they definitely take after their dad. Like we would be doing filming and they're like, I want to be mic'd. I want to be mic'd. And then we were doing this presentation on last Thursday, and I really didn't want to go up on stage. And Cammie's like, oh, just come up for the questions at the end. And my kids are like, well, can't we go up on stage? I want to go up on stage. And they're 9 and 12. And so at the last minute, I said, hey, can my daughters introduce Smokey Miller was going to do a blessing for us. And Cammie's like, yeah, sure, that's great. And so I told them, I said, you can only do it if you'll use some clownic language. And so my youngest daughter got nervous. She's 9, but my 12-year-old stepped up and did her Klamath language. And it wasn't even the language, which is the hard part that messed her up. It was that natives always use nicknames. So she just knows Smokey as Smokey, and his real name's Romaine Miller. And so it was when she had to introduce Romaine Miller that she kind of got messed up because she just wants to call him Smokey. But she got up on the stage, and so they're very different than me in that they want to be like center stage. And so who knows, maybe they'll both get up there and do the Klamath Falls introduction, or somebody will let them introduce them. I don't know.
Okay. Also, you got to use Klamath language, like perfect, mom mode happening there. You're going to speak the language. Oh, wow. Oh, that's exciting. I bet they were off the stage, they feel good too. They're like, yeah, I really did that.
Yeah, my daughter was a little bit embarrassed because she kind of stumbled a little bit, not with the words though. She had some good feedback on how to do that. But yeah, and then my youngest was regretful, like, oh, I wish I would have done it. And so we'll see I don't know who they get to interview in Klamath Falls, but hopefully it's somebody so they can get up there and get the spotlight.
Yeah, and then to see a bigger sister do it too. Now she's gotta.
Yes.
And so speaking of Cammie, there is a whole team from Oregon Public Broadcasting behind sort of putting this documentary together, from what I understand. How did you get connected to the team to start creating this documentary?
It's definitely been a long ride. But I think we need to acknowledge Cammie Horton. So she went to school in Chiloquin. And then after school, she moved over to the Valley and she started working with OPB, Oregon Public Broadcast. And one of her first films she ever did was on the Modoc War. And that film came out in 2011. And it's a great film. You know, it's got Lynn Sconchin, Taylor Tupper, a bunch of different people in there. And for me to watch that film, it was the first time I had seen our history in that sort of setting. And it just blew me away. I was like, this is awesome. And I immediately started using it in my Native Studies class. And in the back of my mind, I was like, that's so cool that Cammie, you know, graduated from Chiloquin and is now in this position to do these sorts of things. And so we had kind of started doing research. And we knew we were probably going to do a boarding school story. And they started finding these mass unmarked graves in Canada. And so this was probably 2019. And so Cammie reached out to Taylor Tupper and said, what can I do to help? How can I help? And Taylor connected her to me. she used her skill set of being a great archive researcher to go through things such as the databases and the national and federal records, census records, and started compiling a list. And so when we started that project, I just assumed I could go into some database, or the tribe had it, a list of all of our tribal members who had gone to boarding school. And no such list exists. And so between Cammie and I, we had a shared Google Docs spreadsheet that we just started plugging names into. And she was able to get huge batches of names by finding lists of people that attended the Indian Agency School in Klamath or out at Yanex. And then we just started building that list. And so she just volunteered because she's like, this is so sad that, you know, they're finding all these bodies and nobody knows this history. And to date, over 10,000 bodies have been found in mass unmarked graves. And most of those are First Nations people up in Canada. But she just called up and said, what can I do to help? And so that's how we initially got connected, was starting to work on a list and research. And I think that was 2019.
Years in the making, that good research. And, you know, we talked to, you know, the first opening scenes you see, photos of your relatives, and the film is very personal and intimate. So what sort of started you down this path? So you get, you know, call from Cammie saying, or from Taylor connecting to Cammie saying, if there's someone who really wants to do something here, what did the internal sort of decision-making process look like for you if you decided to share these details with larger audiences?
Well, the real start of it was the Senate Bill 13, and that's called Tribal History, Shared History. And in 2017, the state of Oregon said, we're going to start requiring schools to teach tribal history. And then the way they did that, which was very smart, was they said, let's let the tribes write their own history. And then they provided funding. And so Julie Bettles, the head of the Department of Education for the Klamath Tribes, was working on that project. And then we ended up creating the Senate Bill 13 ad hoc committee. What we decided to do, you know, being an educator, I knew the power of just a 5-minute film. And so I said, let's take our money from, well, the whole committee agreed, let's take the money from the Oregon Department of Education and make films. Because we can create awesome curriculum, but that curriculum's only going to go to teachers in Oregon. But if we create films, they can go everywhere. And so I volunteered to write the curriculum for the middle school and high school. And then my cousin Amanda Page wrote the curriculum for elementary school. And we ended up doing a total of 4 videos. And one was on the boarding school experience. Then we did one on termination. The last one was on kind of land use and resources. And then Mandy took the lead on doing, it's called Save the Chuam. And that was a video about natural resources in the Chuam and Koptu geared towards elementary school kids. And so that's where it came from. You know, let's create these lessons and create these videos to hopefully outpace the lessons, which I believe they have. And it all came from that Senate Bill 13 committee and the work that went into it. And that was a couple years long project. And, you know, that committee was amazing. Amanda Page, Julie Bettles, Jennifer Jackson, and then we had tribal council support with Clay Dumont, Roberta Frost, and Gail Hatcher. And there was other people who were in there. Nicole Barney was supportive in that. And just overwhelming support to do that and to do that curriculum. But that was where it came from, was let's write these lessons and use videos as kind of our mode to push the lessons forward.
When you said to, you know, videos can reach this larger audience, I was cheering. I was, oh, that is so brilliant. That line is sinking in. Wow, so powerful too. Like, because I'm sure the film now is also going to be shown in classrooms, whether it's high schools or colleges. So to think about the education and community building work, that can be so far reaching with films that are as personal as these ones and the stories that are in them.
Yeah, and we actually were very fortunate. Just we hit up right up at the last deadline. Cami applied for a PBS grant, and she got it. And so it gave us extra funding and national distribution. And so it's not just being shown in Oregon, it's being shown nationally. And so that's a big deal. Because, I mean, if you look at her MODOK War video, and it's been out for a while, it has over 12 million views. That's 12 million people that now know the perspective of the MODOK War from the MODOK side and from their descendants. And that's much different than the perspective of the federal government. And so if this film does half as well, I'll be so happy. But to get that grant and get national distribution was huge.
Wow. I understand as well, it's going to be available in the app soon, end of the month.
I believe it's available online November 1st, and then it will be showed throughout the whole state of Oregon on OPB, Oregon Public Broadcast. I think it's November 3rd at 9 p.m. And then the different places, there's probably, 100 different places across the nation that have picked it up. And I think most of those stations plan on running it through Native American Awareness Month, so during November.
That's so powerful to think about. All of these people are going to be reached. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, I think it might do better number-wise than we can even predict. So that'll be really, really exciting to follow and see the reach and the impact. And you mentioned a little bit about the beginning, like growing up, it was people didn't talk about boarding schools. The trauma was still really fresh. The impacts of it were still felt in a way that was maybe leading people to not wanting to discuss it, and that there's been this shift now. And so I was wondering what the conversations looks like with people who were interviewed to talk about their experience.
I hold all of them, in great value. Just because you're hearing from somebody that lived it. I always see the irony of, whether I'm teaching termination or talking about termination, then I'll look around and be like, wait, you lived it. And it just kind of humbles me and tells me to sit back and shut up and listen. And so that's how those conversations are for me. We sat in one of the survivors that we interviewed, Clay Dumont Sr., and there was probably, maybe 10, 15 of us in there when he was being interviewed, and you could have heard a pin drop. And, I know that the Boarding School Healing Coalition is conducting interviews to save these, and these stories will be housed in the Library of Congress. And the irony is that they're finally collecting the stories now that most of the people have passed. But it was just really, really impactful for me and everybody there, just to let them have that time to acknowledge what had happened to them, and to be able to do it in a safe place. My cousin and I, we kind of talked about this, and the way she described it to me, my cousin Amanda, was that the boarding schools are like a broken bone. And for generations, that bone has just been patched up just to kind of make it through the day. And now in this time, in this place, we're re-breaking that bone, and hopefully in a supportive setting, so that it can be properly set and healed. And so that's kind of been just a goal throughout this project, to let those survivors and those people, and it didn't just impact the ones that were in the schools. They came back thinking that it was normal to parent by hitting and beating. And that's what you did. You yelled and you hit and you punished. And so it's the future generations that were raised by people who had been abused in these schools. It impacted everybody. And so to hopefully finally have the time and the place to let that heal properly in a supportive manner, and then to just sit and take in when those elders are speaking. I would say that was one of the things that I just wish I would have asked or listened more when more people were here. And I'm sure others feel the same way, knowing that their parents had gone through these experiences or their family members or their grandparents. It's like, how come I never asked? How come I just didn't say, is there ever anything you want to talk about? You know, because I do think getting it out helps.
I felt that. Why didn't I ask the questions and starting to dive in and ask them now brings the
Transfers to everybody. I was teaching Japanese internment, and I had a kid in my class, and his grandpa was a code breaker during World War II in the basement in Hawaii, transferring and doing all this stuff. And she's like, I never once asked him a question. And so it's just like, this wealth of information that our elders hold, regardless of if they're indigenous elders or who they are, you never know what stories they're packing. And if we would just humble ourselves and sit and listen, maybe get off our cell phones, what we could learn about anything from how to harvest booze to the life they lived. And when I was a kid, you know, that's how all the stories should start.
This is a PSA as well. Ask your elders about their lives.
Yes.
Yeah, and part of the uncovering sort of I heard you talk about earlier was you knew your mom or your grandma went to this school. And you had to look up and then find out it was a boarding school. I know many people in Oregon probably have heard of Chamawa Indian School, but this documentary dives deeper into the unofficial or not federally labeled boarding schools and the ways that Indigenous families were separated. What, you know, you talked a little bit about record, you talked a little bit about talking to elders. What was the process of uncovering like for you?
It just makes you realize how much you don't know. One of the things that Cami uncovered that was, I say really cool, but I'm sure it wasn't cool to the young ladies that were living it, was the Klamath Indian Agency, you know, just a couple miles from Chiloquin. You know, it's exactly a mile from where my parents live, where I grew up. They had an Indian school there, an Indian boarding school, and they had a girls' dormitory and a boys' dormitory. And I don't know what was going on in that school, but I'm sure it was not the best conditions. But five Klamath girls burnt that dormitory down. And that was an act of resistance. You know, I'm sure there were complaints being launched and nothing was happening and they burnt it down. And it's like, how come I didn't know this? I live a mile away. You know, one of the names is Sconchin, you know, Lena and Lahoma's ancestor. And it's like, you know, we need to know these stories. We need to celebrate these people, you know, fighting back against this oppression. And you know, the stories just aren't told. And so to find that out and be like, oh, good for those girls. And, you know, they were charged with felonies in Portland. And, you know, we don't really know what happened with the case. We know that eventually it was dismissed. And it's probably because I'm going to speculate here. They started to look into the conditions surrounding the school and what was going on. And it was best to, okay, we'll just swipe this one under the rug. But that shut that down. We were in the middle of doing our elder interviews, and Clay Dumont talks about one of the nuns had struck his brother and broke his glasses and his face was bleeding and stuff. And Clay got up and jumped on her back. And so they took him and they were basically held him in a room. And as Clay I'm messing up the story, but Clay jumped on the nun's back and they said, kicked him out. They kicked him and his brother out. And so he was walking out through the front vestibule and it was Christmas time. And so he grabbed that Christmas tree and he yanked it out and he drug it out in the street. And they brought Clay and his brother back in and they stuck him in a room for like 48 hours. And Clay didn't know what was going on. And then they got stuck on the train and shipped home back to Chiloquin. And it wasn't until years later that he was talking to, Clay could tell me, it was a Decker who was there at the school at the time. And he found out that they held all those kids in the school for about 24 hours, and then they shipped them all home and they never took them back. And so Clay didn't know that his act of resistance, of being tired of seeing his twin brother get beat by this nun and ripping down that school and the police, or that tree and the police coming, shut down that St. Mary's for the Native American boarders. They never went back. And he didn't know his whole life that that's what happened until he was sitting in a room with somebody and they're like, yeah, they held us there. And then they sent us all home. You know, you just never know what's going on. But these acts of resistance and resilience were just kept coming up. And so you would learn a new story, and then somebody would come up to you after a presentation or come up to me. I was doing a presentation for the Deschutes County Health Department in Lapine. And, you know, a non-Native lady came up, and she maybe it was in Bend. I can't remember. I've done about 50 of these presentations. And they come up to me afterwards, and she said, it had to be really hard for the kids to go to the schools, but what was it like for the parents to sit in the silence when they were gone? And I had always looked at the schools as, oh, these kids going through these things. And she just in one sentence shifted my paradigm to the impact on the parents with their silent houses, no kids crying, no kids running up and down the hall. To the whole community, you know, what if they had been, you know, oh, every Saturday, you know, we go down to the park and play basketball, and then you go down the next Saturday and there's no kids there. What was that like for the community? And, you know, this is just a comment from a lady, and it shifted my whole entire paradigm. And the number of times that that happened throughout this project, and, you know, sometimes it was people sharing a story or experience or just asking a question. And so it just shows that it's so far from done. The project will continue to grow. And, you know, everybody's going to have different conversations. And I really hope that's what comes from this is, you know, somebody talking to their elder or just asking questions or researching. You never know how big the ripple's going to be, I guess.
Hearing those stories of resistance and then thinking about going to play basketball and all of a sudden the courts are empty, that's such a clear and horrifying picture that I think that's difficult to deal with. That's difficult to think about and process. And so I appreciate that this is an opportunity to process in community and with people. And you also, you know, we talk about ripples, and you did so much research. And I was reading in the promotional materials that records were difficult to impossible to access. Heard that all of a sudden that school was like, uh-oh, they're paying attention to our history. We're going to stop sending them anything or communicating with them. Can you describe some of those challenges and ways you might have overcome the barriers for people who are interested in potentially doing their research into their family after watching this?
I don't know if there's really an easy way to do the research, because initially I was very overconfident. I thought I could just go online and find stuff. And Carlisle has amazing records online. Go online. They have pictures of your ancestor. They have their little intake card. They'll have their report card. Carlisle had a student association. And so you can go and look, like Selden Kirk. I can see him writing back to the student association. Joe Ball would write back to the Carlisle Student Association. And so you get to see your ancestors' cursive handwriting and what they're up to and what they're doing. And that was amazing. Learn to read cursive so you can access these old documents. And so if you have anybody attached to Carlisle, that's a great place to start. Another thing that I know people are working on is digitizing documents. And that's such a huge project, especially for a tribe like ours, where we don't have a museum or a research center. And I can tell you that Cami is going to give everything that she has found back to the tribe. And, you know, another researcher who's writing a book out of Washington is like, hey, I have all this stuff. I just want to give it back to the tribe. And so hopefully we'll be able to kind of create our own archives to do that. And I know when we did the Senate Bill 13 interviews, we wanted to have those available because who knows, a generation from now, somebody might want to come and look at their grandma or grandpa doing those interviews. So that's one start, is kind of narrowing it down to where they went, if you know. The other is accessing the National Archives, which is a hot mess. Our closest one is Seattle. I've gone up there, and I can tell you that within the last 5 years, that archives was on the chopping block, and then the closest one would have been in Oklahoma or Kansas. And so we do want to use that one in Seattle as much as we can to access things. But again, for a long time, I kind of felt like it was just me and this conspiracy theory that things were being covered up and documents weren't being made available. But I can take what happened with the boarding school and I can put it into the context of the Eloise Cobell lawsuit. And so what Eloise Cobell did, and it took 16 years to litigate this lawsuit, but I think it started in 2006, and she sued the federal government for mismanagement of trust funds. The federal government was found to be in breach of their trust responsibility to Native Americans. Then the Department of the Interior, during this lawsuit, was found to be in obstruction of justice. They were literally destroying documents. They were storing documents in lawnmower sheds. There was documents that were infested with the junta virus, and they were held in contempt for covering up documents, destroying documents, and intentionally storing them in places where they would be destroyed. So if that's true when it comes to our money, don't you think it's true when it comes to covering up the atrocities of these schools? And I always throw this out there. When was that report? My head's not firing. But under the John Collier administration in the 1930s, the Merriam Report came out. And I want to say, what the date on the Merriam Report, I want to say it was 1917. But it detailed just how horrific these schools were. It talked about the sex abuse, mental abuse, and physical abuse. So the federal government knew how bad the schools were, and yet left Native children in there for another 75 years. And so to think that it's not against them to cover this up, I think that's why it's so hard to find documents. And the reality is the majority of Native American documents, less than 1% do tribes have. The federal government holds about 30%, and then private religious institutions hold the rest. And so when you try to find your history and you're not able to, there's a plethora of reasons why. My advice would be just to keep digging. And if there's any living record, a person, a story, to go there first. Because, again, it's not easy to find. And I would trust the oral story and not of the Western mindset where you got to have the Western science or something to verify the oral story. I believe the oral story. And who knows if you'll ever be able to verify it with, you know, written documentation, but I believe those to be true. And so I think that's your best resource. But it won't be easy. And then if you have somebody, she uses Ancestry.com, I think, is the one Cami uses. But I think you have to have a paid membership, but people will upload documents to those sites that you may be unaware of. And then, you know, just when you find something, like I love finding something and giving it back to the family. There was a Mabel Hood article, and I was able to give some of that, a picture of her and article that was in what's now the Oregonian about her being returned from Carlisle to her family members. And so restoring that history to family members is huge. I think every Indigenous person wants that history that just hasn't been written, hasn't been found. And so if you can ever restore that to them, I think that's awesome.
That's amazing. That's both incredible advice. And I feel like validating for probably a lot of folks who've maybe tried to go down this road and wondered why the roadblocks are listed.
And I will say, I'll throw the caveat, the Klamath tribe's even worse than every other tribe because we were terminated and lost all of our documents. And, you know, I thought the federal government was holding them for us. And, you know, we met with one of the highest up people at the federal government, National Archives, and they don't have our records. They have their copy because there was two copies of everything. But our records post-termination are not in our possession and are not in the federal government's possession. And so I just thought they had them. Once we got a museum, we were going to get them all back. But no, the federal government, National Archives, do not have our records. So talk about, and that was something that our production company told us, because, you know, we were doing a termination video on the boarding school video, and it's their job to sleuth out these assets, is what they call them in the production field. And they said never in their careers had they come into such a complete void of information. And, you know, Henry at Wahoo Film said, it's almost like it was intentionally erased. And I'm like, booyah, Henry, you're right. It was. It was intentionally erased and intentionally covered up. And it's the same with the termination documents.
Even this film is an act of resistance against that void. And those words, resistance and resilience, are central to the title. I was wondering if you could let our listeners know a little bit about what the conversation was like to use those specific words and what it means to you that they're in the title.
That was an Abby edit. I didn't do a lot of behind the screens editing. You know, usually I do. When we did the Senate Bill 13 videos, I was really hands-on and, you know, in the weeds. But this one, I was just more of a subject being interviewed. But I think we focus on generational trauma. That's a real thing. We see that in our communities every single day. But what we don't focus on is resistance and resilience. And when those stories have been covered up, you know, not even Clay knew that his resistance that day shut down that school to Native American borders. And so I wanted to focus on that because I think oftentimes natives are seen as victims. And it doesn't mean that we haven't had bad things happen to us, but we have not let those bad things define us as who we are and what we are. We're greater than the things that have been done to us. And so I think we have to shift that paradigm. We have to shift the paradigm from natives seen as like, oh, they just belong in a museum, to no, we're active members of your society today, or you're active members of our society today. It would even be a better paradigm. But I wanted to show that. And there was resistance throughout. I won't say everybody, but a lot of us know of an ancestor that ran away from boarding school. That's resistance. That's resilience. Joe Ball is one of the stories I tell that I talk about. And he ran all the way from Carlisle. That's over 2,000 miles back. And then he ended up opening up the Sand Creek gas station. And so I tell people, just when you drive by the Sand Creek gas station and you see that store, that's a sign of resilience. Don't ever go by without giving a war whoop or something. But we don't know. We don't know that he traveled 2,000 miles back. And him and Clayton Kirk. So Joe Ball and Clayton Kirk originally ran away. And this is when General Pratt, the founder of the boarding schools, is running the boarding school in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And they made it almost 250 miles to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And they were brought back to Carlisle. And I don't know what happened. I know Clayton got really sick and was sent back home. Clayton and Selden were sent back home and then later sent down to Phoenix Indian School. But Joe was still there. And so Joe ran a second time. And somehow he made it over 2,000 miles back. And Natalie and Tom have some of these stories, Tom Ball and Natalie Ball, about how like he was a rodeo clown and he played some baseball and just kind of worked his way across the country, you know, at 18 years old until he got back. And then he opened up that gas station. But I'm like, that's resilience. Who could, I mean, a kid today, I would love to see you make it back across the United States with like, I mean, can you make it back from school without your cell phone? These kids did amazing things. So if you have an ancestor and you know, hey, their transcript says deserter from Chamawa, that's something to be proud of. And so I want us to acknowledge the trauma, but I think part of the healing and telling your story and acknowledging it is moving past the trauma and focusing on the resilience and the resistance that goes along with that. And there's power in telling our own story, and that we can choose to focus on those things is amazing. And the documentary goes even deeper. It goes into, you know, the forced sterilization going into those schools. It goes into Klamath tribal members being held in the mental hospital. All kinds of things that I didn't even know it was going to go into. I would say it does an excellent job. Just buckle in, because there is so much history, everything from, you know, being forced onto the reservation to termination to boarding schools and everything else that has kind of come since.
Yeah, I think that hearing those words too, I, you know, from the beginning you said, like, you're intervening and putting information where there is a void, and you're intervening on this narrative that Indigenous people are just museum artifacts or are belong in a time past. But that's so powerful. And so this particular documentary focuses on the Klamath tribes. Why do you think it's important for folks in Klamath to come out to the showing that's going to be happening? And what do you hope that they will take away from it?
I think it gives a broader context. For the non-tribal members, it can explain some of the history and the things that you may see today. I do know that the Klamath School District, at their new employee orientation, shows our Senate Bill 13 video, which is a 7-minute video. And that adds context to, you know, if you're doing parent-teacher conferences and you have somebody coming in and you're like, huh, they view education differently, you're going to have a little window into why Natives view education and the government and its entities differently if you understand boarding schools. But if you take that 7-minute clip and then you expand it into an hour and get that a larger context, you're going to have greater empathy and understanding of why the Klamath people are the way that they are. And so I think that's important for the non-Native audience to see. And then for the Indigenous or the Native audience to see your history represented and told is a powerful thing. And again, this was the thing that I was the most uncomfortable with, is these are not my stories. These are our stories. And I do not like being the focal person or the person in the front, because people are telling them to me, or we're finding them, and I'm just the face that's going with those. And I see it as I'm just carrying the stories. You know, it's kind of like a troubadour. You carry the history and the songs and the stories from place to place. And I just have been fortunate enough to have a platform to do that, whether it's in a classroom or it's at a presentation or it's at a podcast or now, you know, in a documentary. There our history, our stories. And so I strongly, firmly stand behind the message and the history that's shared. I just don't like being the vessel that's sharing it. And so, you know, maybe people can come and they can learn something about, you know, their ancestors, and then they can be the person to share that. I think that's really powerful. But that would kind of be my hope. And just to take away kind of the veil of ignorance. And again, that ignorance is not intentional. This history is not taught for a reason. You know, people, especially Indigenous people, will take on the burden of, well, I didn't know that. This is my own tribe and I didn't know. And it's like, you don't know for a reason. You weren't given documents for a reason. This narrative wasn't in the newspaper for a reason. And so to take the initiative to educate yourself is what Native people have to do, where dominant society doesn't have to take on that role. But that would kind of be my hope. And then for it to be healing for some people, just like at the last event where it was the Natives that got up and talked about their experience. I believe that was healing for them.
As a reminder to our listeners, the film is being shown October 24th at the Ross Raglan Theater in Klamath Falls and will be shown in Forest Grove October 28th at Pacific University. Both events are free and open to the public, but please get tickets in advance at opb.org/events. Mosup Getcha to Gebrian Hall for being so generous with your time and the entire team at Oregon Public Broadcasting that made this episode possible. Thank you to everyone whose story was included for bravely creating an intervention in the record. Also, thank you to the Ross Raglan and Klamath Tribal Health and Family Services for bringing the showing here. Thank you to the Steiger Butte Singers for the music you heard today, which was originally recorded at the Klamath Tribe's Restoration Powwow in August of 2023.